This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
I'm going to tell you a part of my lab and part of my work that's really focused on women and girls on the spectrum. And I just want to give some context for this. And I think about this in terms of the growing rates of the prevalence of autism. When I got into the field in 2005, it was about 1 in 100 kids with autism. And as you all know, it has really skyrocketed across the 2 decades that I've been working in this field. However, I think one of the most consistent findings within the whole field of autism research is this male to female ratio, this disproportionate number of boys who are diagnosed with autism. It's about 4 boys for every 1 girl that's diagnosed with autism. And this has stayed very, very consistent across this time. However, as the numbers have gone up, there have been more girls identified with autism. So in the latest CDC report, 1 in 36 children are diagnosed with autism, and that goes for 1 in 88 girls. And so we can no longer think of girls as rare in autism. There's 1 in 88 girls now diagnosed with autism. They have been ignored for far too long by the field. But just because there's sheer numbers of growth in autistic children, there are more girls now, and we can study them and learn about what their support needs are. So unfortunately, for the first 2 decades, the majority of the research study samples really reflected this 4-to-1 bias, but it has started to change. And so here's my soapbox, one of my soapbox messages: autistic females should no longer be considered too rare to recruit. We can and should achieve more sex-balanced cohorts. And I have an asterisk by autistic females because I am talking about sex assigned at birth throughout this talk. So I just wanted to give a little bit of a background on what we have learned. And in the past maybe 5 or 10 years, there really has been a focus on identifying more about sex differences and specific needs and challenges faced by autistic girls. And so this is just a smattering of results that I have that I've chosen to share with you today. But I think one thing that's really, really important to know is that girls are still diagnosed about 1 to 1.5 years later than boys. I'm actually surprised by this number, but it's about 7 years for girls compared to about 5 or 5.5 is the average age of diagnosis for boys. And of course, what this means is that autistic girls are missing out on those early years of intervention. These are also the girls who are getting diagnosed. There is definitely still within the field a lot of girls going misdiagnosed or underdiagnosed. But that's a whole separate talk. What we know about diagnosed girls with autism, though, are that there are differences in the trajectory of their autism symptom severity. So within our study, actually, that I'm going to be telling you about, girls appear to improve across early childhood, but this pattern seems to reverse in adolescence. And you can think about this perhaps in terms of, you know, young girls, 6-year-old girls in elementary school, they can navigate the social milieu. But when you get to adolescence, middle school, high school, those social challenges become much more complex, especially for girls. And there we see them struggle more. And why that's important is that we need to support them. We need to recognize that these changes are happening so that we can support them and support their mental health. The next point is that a higher proportion of girls diagnosed with autism have co-occurring symptoms of anxiety and depression even as early as age 3. So this actually came from our study as well. And that is just a huge wake-up call to me in terms of what we need to be doing to better support the girls. A higher proportion of school-aged females have sleep problems. And then I think most strikingly, autistic women are at higher risk than autistic males for attempted suicide. That alone is a reason why we should be paying attention, right? So all of these, I think, are just really important to know that there are autistic girls and women out there and that we need to be studying them. I'm a neuroscientist, so I'm going to pivot a little bit and talk a little bit about the brain. So I think I've sort of convinced you, hopefully clinically, that we should be looking at girls. But why should we care about sex differences in the autistic brain? And so here, I'd just like to start with this idea that there are sex differences at all levels of neurobiological organization. When I got into this field, I started reading a lot of these review papers really showing that there are sex differences in, you know, Larry Cahill was he was very influential in my early work. And then imaging studies have also shown that male and female brains grow at different rates. So this picture on the left is showing that you that girls tend to have a peak in their gray matter volume earlier than boys. And there have also been reports of differences in the structural connectivity patterns, with girls having more inter-hemispheric connectivity and boys more intra within the hemisphere. So we need to pay attention. When we talk about looking at the autistic brain, sex is definitely a variable that we need to be paying attention to. And I think why we need to care is that we want to know both the similarities as well as the differences across autistic males and females relative to their sex-specific non-autistic peers, right? So we shouldn't be comparing autistic males to autistic females. We have to be comparing autistic males to non-autistic males and likewise, and then look for the interactions there. And what I believe is that, or what drives my research, is that I think that sex-convergent alterations, differences that we see consistent across both of the sexes, may be these defining neural characteristics of autism, but we can use these sex-specific alterations that we identify to perhaps understand different underlying etiologies, and even more importantly, be useful in predicting different outcomes, different co-occurring conditions, and support needs, interventions, timing of interventions, things like that. We can't assume that all of those things should be the same for autistic males and autistic females. So now let me tell you what I'm going to tell you about today. So I'm going to give you an overview of the Autism Phenome Project and the GAIN studies. I'll tell you a little bit about recent findings from our study. Those are the science parts. And then I do want to dedicate a good portion of the talk to talking about neuroteens, which really came from my research program, but it is completely not data-driven. It's really a support group for autistic girls that I started. But first, let me tell you about the science part. So the Autism Phenome Project was founded in 2006 by David Amaral. I had come to work with him as a postdoc in 2005 when he was starting the Autism Phenome Project. And the goal was to enroll children, all children with autism, with very few exclusion criteria, as early as possible, as close in time to their diagnosis. So at the time, that was about 2 years of age. We now have over 500 children enrolled, and critically, it's a longitudinal study. So some of those kids that we first enrolled in 2006, they're now 18, 19 years old, and we've followed them all the way through childhood into adolescence. And the overarching goal of this project was to identify clinically meaningful subtypes of autism. So we've talked a little bit about the heterogeneity of autism and the idea that not every intervention works for every child with autism because they have different underlying biology. And so trying to subgroup them based on their biology and their behavioral characteristics, we might be able to target better interventions for each subset of autism. But the original APP project was just recruiting sort of autistic kids off the street. And so we were recruiting at a 4-to-1 ratio of boys to girls. So in this chart, I just show you our participants broken down by autism and non-autistic. And then you can see there's a lot more boys than girls in the Autism Phenome Project. At the time, it was more like 150 boys to about 30 girls in the study. And so in 2014, I decided to launch the Girls with Autism Imaging of Neurodevelopment Study to try to increase the representation of females within the Autism Phenome Project. And so during that time, it's actually very hard to find 2-year-old girls who are diagnosed with autism in 2014. 10 years later, it's a little bit easier, but it's still pretty tricky. But we have now over about 150 girls in our data set who have all been identified early on, and we have neuroimaging in all of them. So it's a really valuable data set to have. I think it might be the largest single site study of brain differences in autistic females. Somewhere, anywhere, I don't know. And we're now following our original cohort into middle childhood, where we're looking at the emergence of things like ADHD and anxiety. And our original APP girls are now 15 to 18, and so they're looking into adolescence. So the whole study includes neuroimaging, which is where I come in, and we have our 5 time points that you can see here. From 2 to 15 to 18 years of age, we collect comprehensive behavioral and cognitive assessments on them. We have a medical component where we look at their medical history and they get a physical exam. We look for pubertal status there. And then we collect their blood so we can look at their immunology and genetics as well. And so data collection is ongoing at all time points. I think my team has been messaging me. We've had like 5 MRI scans in the last 48 hours, and It's very busy. And we have about 300 active families at various stages of all of the different time points in the study. A word on the pediatric scanning. So how do we get these MRI scans in all of these kids? This is really how I sort of made my mark at the Mind Institute, because David Amaral said, "Christine, come be a postdoc in my lab and let's scan two-year-olds during sleep." And I was like, okay, this is going to be a super short postdoc because there's no way this is going to work. But as luck would have it, I had a child right around the time when I started my postdoc. And so my daughter Clara is actually in the study. I happen to have a two-year-old. I could relate to the parents and how hard it was going to be to scan a two-year-old during sleep and build that trust. And I just knew what they were going through. So we actually have like a 90% success rate in getting MRI scans in two-year-old children all the way up through age 5. And then after around age 5, sleep scanning doesn't work as well in them. And you can see what we did here with the bedroom, like trying to turn the MRI scanner into a less intimidating environment. But then our kids grew up, and actually our cohort has a significant representation of children with intellectual disability. So this is something I'm really proud of, that 40% of our cohort actually has IQs less than 70, which is representative of the general population, but not representative of most neuroimaging studies in autism. But as these kids grew up, we could no longer scan them during sleep, and so we developed these individualized behavioral supports to get children who are non-speaking, who have intellectual disability, through MRI scans, and they can do so much more than what we presumed that they could do, right? Presumed competence is, I think, a really important thing here. And our success rate in getting scans in this, in the kids with lower IQ in our study is about 70%. So, you know, kids can do it. We just have to give them the opportunity. So that's my other soapbox. So this is just a chart that I love, showing the number of cumulative MRI scans that we've collected, over 1,200 MRI scans in this study across my entire career, I guess. So what are we trying to do? We're trying to subgroup. So the autism spectrum, and we try to subgroup based on different sort of characteristics. So developmental characteristics, clinical characteristics such as co-occurring anxiety, depression, medical, so GI symptoms. We're looking at joint hypermobility and hypotonia and different motor sorts of issues, and then biological, sex, genetics, and the brain. So that's what I'm going to focus on today, is what we've looked at in terms of thinking about females as really a subgroup of autism. And the overarching goal is to identify these clinically meaningful subtypes of autism to better inform the etiological mechanisms, supports, and interventions, and ultimately to help with outcomes. So I'm going to tell you about, I think, three different recent findings from the GAINS study, and I'll just do that. So one thing that we have done, so this is work done by Derek Andrews, who was a postdoc in my lab, and now he's a junior faculty member, a project scientist for those of you in the UC system that know this. And he looked, we have now this cohort of about 1,200 MRI scans spanning from 2 to 12 years of age, and we just wanted to see how the cortex was developing in these kids. So we looked at this index called cortical thickness, which I have just illustrated here. And you can see, you know, the cerebral cortex is where all of the neurons live, so that's the gray matter of the brain, and the thickness of that cortex changes across development. And we wanted to look at how that thickness was changing in boys and girls. And this is a paper that was published earlier this year, and what was really surprising to me was that we saw much more different between autistic boys and girls than we saw similarities. And so we saw that the cortical development from 3 to 12 years of age was faster in autistic girls across many different functional networks of the brain. This actually, so all of the blue regions show where the cortex is growing faster. It's actually getting thinner at a higher rate than boys. And this actually comprises about 12% of the entire cortex, which was, it's pretty surprising to me, actually. In contrast, there was maybe, I think it was 1% of the cortex where boys had a faster growth rate. And okay, so why do we care about this? Why is this important? Well, I think it matters to know that different brain regions are growing at different rates across girls and boys, because this could really have an impact on their behavioral development too. And it could tell us something about the timing of interventions or the timing of behaviors that we expect are emerging in girls and boys might be different. And so the second study I want to tell you about is a study done by my current postdoc, Olivia Surgeon. And she came from a motor background, and motor is really, really, I think, important and understudied in autism, but it's kind of this hot field right now. And she wanted to know whether the brain at age 3 could predict motor skill development across early childhood. So we took our MRI scans at age 3, and then she looked at the developmental trajectory of motor skill development out to age 6. And one question was to ask, you know, are there differences in how the brain is predicting motor development in our non-autistic and autistic cohorts? Are the relationships different in autism? And then layering on sex as well, are there differences between autistic boys and autistic girls? And so she looked at a part of the brain called the dorsal striatum. So this includes the caudate and the putamen. So those are the structures there. And then she also looked at she used diffusion-weighted imaging to look at the structural connectivity of these two regions, projecting out to sensory motor areas and to prefrontal areas, which we think are more involved in cognition. And what she found is that in both of these white matter pathways, so let me break this down a little bit for you. On the top there, you can see the brain that shows the white matter pathways that she was looking at that are projecting from the putamen to the sensory motor areas. And then on the y-axis, we're looking at the rate of motor development from age 3 to age 6. And you can see that there is a relationship between the fractional anisotropy of this integrity of the white matter tract in girls, but not in boys. And it's a pretty striking difference. So that yellow line shows that the higher fractional anisotropy, the greater the gains in motor skills was happening in autistic girls, but the opposite was happening in boys. Well, that's not a significant correlation, but you can think of that as flat. When we look at, so those are the sensory motor projections. When we look at the prefrontal projections that are more involved in cognition, she saw the same thing, associations in girls that we didn't see in boys. And so what does this mean? And we didn't see the same relationships in non-autistic children. And, you know, this is a puzzling result. What do you do with something like this, where you see an association in the brain and development of motor in one sex but not the other? And I think there's a lot more work that needs to be done in unpacking this, but I think initially my interpretation of this is that the neural mechanisms of motor development could be different in autistic girls, or at least there could be a difference in the timing of when these white matter tracts are developing. And I think for me that implies that there could be differences in when interventions, motor interventions, might be more impactful in one sex versus another. And maybe perhaps the type of intervention would also need to be considered. And so I think that identifying these sex differences in brain behavior associations longitudinally is like a first step in trying to get to that idea of more personalized and targeted interventions. And the last study I want to talk about is something that the autism field loves dearly, is just joint attention. Joint attention is the sharing of of attention with a social partner at something. So this idea of pointing and looking and following your point, I'm sure you all know about this. And it's really, you know, there hasn't been as much work done on sex differences in joint attention, but we know that joint attention is really an important developmental skill that happens between 6 and 18 months of age, and that there are a lot of studies that show that joint attention is altered in kids with autism. It's been associated with language development, social skills, IQ, adaptive functioning, and this is work that's done by Andy Dikopoulos, another postdoc in my lab. And so here, we also are working with Peter Mundy on this, and we wanted to look at sex difference in joint attention and whether early joint attention skills can predict later outcome of IQ. And so our question here, I just said it, sex differences in joint attention and different effects of joint attention on the trajectory of intellectual disability, or ability, sorry, IQ scores. And what he found here again was this different pattern, this interaction between sex and autism. And so at age 3, first of all, so this graph, the font is small, I'm sorry. But at age 3, we found that girls, autistic girls, have better joint attention skills than autistic boys. And then as we followed them out across time, from 3 to 6 years of age, we found that in autistic girls, bigger improvements, so their increases in the amount of joint attention that they were using, predicted their IQ at age 11 in a stronger manner than it happened in boys. And I think this is also interesting just to think about again in terms of implications for interventions. Autistic girls may benefit more from improvements in joint attention at very young ages. So maybe that's when you want to target interventions for girls. So again, we're just trying to get to more precise ways to support autistic girls and boys. I'm just going to summarize here quickly the few studies that I've told you about. We have a review paper. There have actually been many different subgroups and subtypes that we're looking at. But hopefully, this is a data set that I think we'll have for a long time, and a lot of interesting results are going to be coming from it. But I think that we have David Amaral's vision of having this large-scale multidisciplinary study was, I think, really, really important. Adding in the sex-balanced piece, I think, was really critical as well. So right now, as I said, we're identifying early predictors of co-occurring ADHD and anxiety. We really want to look at how puberty, so there's evidence of earlier puberty in autistic girls and how that's affecting brain development. And then finally, I am here looking at assigned sex at birth, but we do want to evaluate gender diversity and non-binary identities as well, because there are higher rates of gender diversity in autistic populations. All right, so I'm not sure how much time I have left. I might go into the questions a little bit, but I want to tell you about NeuroTeens, which is our support group for neurodivergent girls. So this came because one of the families in my research study, the GAINS study, the mom asked me, she said, my daughter's in high school now. She's really struggling. All of the groups there are male dominated. She doesn't feel like she fits in. Do you know of anything out there that's made specifically for autistic girls? So we're the MIND Institute. I asked around, and there was a group for older women on the spectrum, but nothing for teenage girls in high school. And so I remember very vividly, I sent out a Slack to my lab and said, who wants to start a group for autistic girls with me? And within 6 weeks, we started this. So it is founded, we started this in July 2021. Completely volunteer-led. These are study coordinators from various labs at the MIND Institute. They do this all of their own free will, and we all love it. I just want to highlight a few that are our lead coordinators there who have been working with. Some of them are off to grad school now. But it's all volunteer-led. It's non-clinical. It's really just a social support group. And the reason I'm telling you about this is because it's so impactful, and it's really kind of easy to do. So my hope is that more people and more places will start NeuroTeens groups, because what it does is it gives these girls a community. It lets them know that they're not alone. There are other people out there like them. And it's just the most heartwarming, wholesome thing that we experience. So within 1 week, we had 28 interested families that signed up. Parents gave us lots of topics that they wanted us to cover. Teens, it turns out, did not so much want to cover these topics. They just wanted to hang out with each other. So we've really pivoted from the pilot session, not talking at them, like everyone was tired of Zoom school by then. We just let them hang out, and it's really driven by them. And so, we have them sign an agreement. I think the first two bullet points are the most important, to provide an opportunity to meet other neurodivergent teens like yourself, to support your understanding of the unique ways that your mind works, and really just creating the safe space for them to connect. We've had 14 sessions so far, so we just completed our fall 2024 session. We've had 70 teens participate from all over the country, so it started out as a Sacramento thing, and we had in-person gatherings. It turns out, though, teens don't want to come hang out at the MIND Institute. They don't think that that's so fun. So I've had parents then arrange like pizza party dates and things like that, and that has been more fun for them. They didn't want to come to the MIND Institute. We've had 21 volunteer facilitators. We've had kids from Massachusetts, Indiana. They found us on Google somehow, and they just signed up. That's the beauty of Zoom, I think. The four red ones there are the most popular topics. So we have hobbies and show and tell, trivia night. We do a scavenger hunt with the kids where they have to go find something in their house that's purple, and they come back and talk about it. We have art night where they go create something for 10 minutes and they come back and share it. And I love it because it started with drawings, but now we have singing as a form of art. We have, it's just beautiful. A couple quotes to share. So NeuroTeens, these are from parents. NeuroTeens has created a safe space for the teens to be themselves, learn from one another. They support one another in a way I haven't seen in other groups. And then Lizzie, who I'm going to show you a video of next, this is her mom saying, "Neuroteens is the first time Lizzie has been able to connect with teens similar to herself in an environment that is based on being supportive and accepting of all. Neuroteens has helped fill a gap that was missing in Lizzie's life. Our family is forever grateful for the opportunities, skills, and friendships that Lizzie has been able to develop being a part of this community." I mean, how meaningful is that? It's so great. As a researcher that sticks kids in MRI scanners, like this is what makes me proud. So let me just share with you Lizzie's testimonial. She did tell me, "Thank you for creating my autistic haven," which I love.
Hi, I'm Lizzie. 3 years ago, my mom and I found this program for neurodiverse teens, and we decided to try it out. Who knew that this program would become so special to me? Who knew that I would become a facilitator and make friends with the neurodiverse teens in this neuroteens program? I was really excited to try this program and see other neurodiverse individuals like me. Some like to draw like I do, and some have different interests, but they're all really nice, and so are the neuroteens leaders. I have so much fun on neuroteen sessions like art night and trivia night. In neuroteens, I can share my art, and everyone is always so supportive of me. I began texting for the first time when I was chatting with my neuroteens' best friends. We even get together sometimes, and it's always nice seeing them face to face. When I graduated from the program, I was given the option of becoming a facilitator. At first, I was nervous, but then after a while, I actually started to like being a facilitator. As a facilitator, I talk with the other teens during neuroteens meetings, and I help plan meetings with other facilitators. Being a facilitator helps me become a better leader, take more responsibility, and I get to continue being a part of a program that I love. This program is so special to me, and I'm so proud to be part of a program that supports me. Thank you.
So, I do it for Lizzie, right? Hold on, I have one more video to show you if you'll just bear with me. So Issa's mom is the one who asked me about this group at first, and I just wanna play you, I'm gonna close with a poem by Issa.
You ready?
Yes.
People wonder what it's like living in a prison, a prison. Some say it only hits some, about 3 million. Saying vaccines, parasitism, but it's not that it is them, it's in them. A spectrum within them, the tisms and odd disorder given. Some things are too loud, too strong, too bright. We fight the fight, try to get people to see us right, see the light, see we need some help to see our might. They don't know what it's like, we live a different life. We twitch at times, we see a different sight. We like routine, and with all we've seen, we're the color of the rainbow, everything in between. They say we're fine when we're high, and act like autism makes us die, like we're unaware, like we don't care, like we're always in their hair, like we're a burden to bear. We aren't alive, they say. We're diseased. We can't talk or hear, spreading rumors and fear like we have no ears. And while we're here fighting our tears, we adhere to different rules. Have I made myself clear? If I don't look autistic, you must have mistook. Something's up with my brain, and it don't gotta look. We live in a world of colors no one will ever see. I'm not always alone. It's not just forever me. Ever free, let me be, cleverly. I'm different, not less. My mind's not a hot mess. I can hear. I'm not thoughtless. I'm ingrained, not insane, not one insane. You can't end us, can't mend us, it can be hard to bend us. Do we seem so abnormal? Our autism's immortal. We can't be changed because we're all above normal.
This is my ploy to get applause at the end of my talks. I just show Issa. But no, really, I do just want to end with a special thanks to all of our participants, our team, and all of my wonderful lab. So thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to share this today.
When does the next group start?
So Oh, I should have included it. I think there's a link in the bio to my lab website. It's going to start January 13th. We run in six-week sessions. We do have a wait list. So my reason My reason for coming here is you guys could start your own NeuroTeens group. I mean, I think ATP, like, it's very easy. But we do have sessions that are ongoing. We will start another one in January. And you are welcome to look on my lab website and sign up. So we try to keep it at about 15 teens per session.
Do you have any resources there for guidance on how to start?
We'd be happy to talk to you about that. So, yeah.
Thank you.
All these teens need is a space. You just have to create the space for them and they find each other.
Christine, thank you for such an interesting talk. So I noticed that I think you had something like 22% identified as non-binary. Is that right?
That was the composition of NeuroTeens non-binary, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit more about that, like your understanding of sort of, you know, we also see a similar thing with youth that are at risk for psychotic spectrum disorders, which, and it does appear to be higher than, you know, the general population of teenagers. And, you know, so, yeah, what is your thinking about why or, you know, and then are, you know, do you think that interventions need to be adapted for, you know, gender diverse autistic teens?
So in the science part, so we actually in our cohort, you know, we have about, as we've had these kids age grow up, we've asked them now added questions about gender identity. And in the autistic population, I think, it's like 11% of gender diverse individuals in autism. In our cohort, we are seeing similar rates. And really, this is sort of driven by the kids in our cohort. I'm like, we have to start paying attention to this. So I'm really interested. There's another junior faculty member in my lab, Josh Lee, who is really interested in trying to tease apart sex differences versus gender differences in the brain. So a lot of the sex differences that we see in the brain in autism are really an attenuation of sex differences that we see in non-autistic populations. And what he wants to do is try to understand whether that's mapping onto gender identity in any way. I think that's a reasonable hypothesis. And so we are starting to look at gender, non-binary, trans individuals, layering that on top of the sex assigned at birth that we're seeing. In terms of NeuroTeens, it was started as a group for autistic girls, but we very quickly opened it up to gender diverse teens as well, because they need a space as well. So much of the autism, you know, social skills groups and things like that are really dominated by cisgender males, and nothing against them, but we wanted to create a space for, and there are a lot of assigned females that identify as non-binary and trans in our group. So we just did it. We sort of followed the need for that.
Hi, thank you so much for your presentation. I'm a speech therapist. I work with the pediatric population. And I was wondering, how do you see your research influencing the like standardized assessment measures that are currently used for diagnosis of autism in kids? Because I certainly feel like the assessment measures we use are a large part as to why girls are underdiagnosed or diagnosed so much later in life.
Oh my goodness, this is a whole nother talk, right? And it's not my area of expertise, I'm not a clinical psychologist, but I think that there's a lot more attention paid to this. And I think, you know, the ADOS is an incredibly valuable tool, and we have not seen sex differences within the ADOS, but again, we're looking at kids who've been diagnosed using the ADOS. So perhaps it's not surprising that we don't see sex differences there. I was just talking to Jonathan, like what we need to be studying is the girls who are not picked up in the clinic. And right now, like with the way that we write grants, the first thing you have to do is they have to have a diagnosis of autism, right? And then if they don't, they're excluded. And I need to write a grant where we can relax that criteria a little bit, because it breaks my heart every time I have to exclude a female that doesn't meet on the 45-minute assessment that we've done in the clinic, where mom's like, if she's stressed, if something happens, you know, that's where it comes out. I will say, though, you know, research is not a clinical diagnosis. Research is its own world of strict criteria. And so I'm heartened, like, we always tell the girls, don't tell anyone that you didn't meet for criteria at the Mind Institute in a research study. We don't want you to lose your services. And I think in the clinical world, there is a little bit more flexibility there with a diagnosis, which I think is hopeful. But yeah, we as a field, we need to figure out how to better support them. The ADOS works really well, though. And I think the clinicians being trained in, you know, taking more time or seeing them in multiple settings and across time, I think that really needs to happen more in girls to get the full picture of their presentation. I don't know if that answered your question, but those are my thoughts.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.